Welcome to Power of the Tribe podcast. I'm your host, John Connors. I'm the founder and head instructor of Connors Martial Arts here in Norwood, Massachusetts. We teach Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, Muay Thai, kickboxing, and mixed martial arts. Reach out to us, come down. We'll welcome you with open arms, and we'll help you learn and grow in your martial arts career. And I'm here with my host, Dan Robin. How you doing, Dan?
Good.
Good. I'm not even going to ask for a numerical assessment.
Yeah, skip it today.
I want to ask you how you're doing a little bit more, but I want people to know we have some great material coming up. We have 10 jiu-jitsu directives, orders from me that you must do if you're training jiu-jitsu. I would call them the 10 commandments, but it's not really that biblical, and I got more coming later. So this is
just
the initial.
These apply to anybody doing jiu-jitsu.
You're doing jiu-jitsu, you must do these. These are must-dos. If you don't do these, I'm going to be infuriated.
10 must-dos. Like, I knew you were coming up with must-dos, but I didn't know you'd come up with 10.
I got more. This is just the tip of the iceberg. But yes, they are directives.
Not optional.
Not optional. Commandments, if you will. You know why? I mean, Dan, I was thinking about this a lot this week. One of the things I appreciate about you is you're a nuanced thinker. You know what I mean? Like, you can...
That's somewhat true.
Right. Exactly. And there's less and less nuanced thinking in the world today, so it seems.
Right.
But I think, by and large, people do not want to listen to nuanced thinking. Because if you talk to me with nuanced ideas and thoughts, I have to think about them. I have to spend energy thinking about them. And most people do not want to do that. They do not want to spend energy thinking at all.
Right. We've talked before, there's some people that actually get angry at nuanced thinking.
They get annoyed at nuanced thinking.
Yeah, annoyed. They don't like it.
Yeah, because you're requiring them to think. That's why. And they're like, can you just make it simple?
Right.
So I think as gurus that we are, we're both gurus, and leaders, we have to speak with conviction. People are looking for certainty. They want certainty from us, Dan. They do not want nuanced thinking.
Got it. And so you came up with 10 to start with.
To start with.
The reason you were saying commandments is that they are actual.
These are must-dos.
Certainty to them.
There's certainty with this. Conviction. Yeah. I was thinking this week, Dan, I'm going to continue thinking with nuance, but I'm going to communicate with conviction. What do you think about that?
That makes sense.
That's good. A good little pithy thing? Think with nuance, communicate with conviction.
Yeah, I hadn't heard it before. That's good.
Well, I made it up. Yeah. Of course you haven't heard it before. I made it up just yesterday.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I don't know. This morning or yesterday, you know. And the word conviction, Dan, oftentimes communicators use etymology to describe words and convey their argument. And they usually come up with a completely erroneous etymology, and it drives me insane. You know, Tony Robbins had that one of desire, he said, means of the Father, and it has nothing. He said it comes from the Latin of the Father, and it doesn't at all. And
like desire.
That's what he
was making that up.
Yeah, it's like pig Latin. Yeah. No, Tony, it comes from pig Latin. I mean, so it's something you can literally Google and find out where it comes from.
And he always talks with conviction.
He always talks with conviction.
I don't remember if we talked about this on the podcast or I just talked with you about it, where I saw that Tony Robbins special. And he's a guy who's an absolute guru, right? Like thousands and thousands.
And the name of the special is I'm Not Your Guru. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it is.
Yeah.
But he would talk with certainty about things that even watching it on TV, you could tell he was wrong. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And people, he would sort of bully people into agreeing. Like, he'd be in front of a crowd and be like, I think you know that you need to leave your boyfriend. And whoever he's talking, like someone that he just met. And he'd be like, it's very, very clear that he's holding you back after 20 seconds. And the woman would be like,
he made the woman take out her cell phone and call her boyfriend at work and break up with him.
Right.
Dan, in that case, he was certain. He was right. Because any nudnik, any wacko that would do that should break up with the boyfriend, because that guy is in for misery with this woman. So
it helped the guy.
Helped the guy. Did him a huge favor.
Yeah. It was just clear, too, the way he'd talk to people in front of a crowd and sort of bully them into agreeing. You know, like
he does, and he uses those old churchy tactics. He'll say some statement and then say, who agrees with that? Say yeah. And the crowd goes, yeah. Then people
So now we're going to be more like that.
We're going to be more like that. Right.
Who out there agrees with us?
Let me hear you say yeah. Definitely. I am going to continue to think with great nuance, and I'm going to speak and communicate with great conviction. And the word conviction, This is where I get off the topic. The etymology.
Does that come from Pig Latin?
It comes from Pig Latin and from Latin. As Tony Robbins, I'm certain Tony Robbins does not know this, but conviction comes from the same word where we get the word victory from. It comes from the word for conquer. You know, the famous phrase from Julius Caesar, I came, I saw, I conquered. Veni, vidi, victi. This is it. So,
conviction. So now the listeners also have learned something, learned some etymology.
Vici. Did I say victi? Vici. Yeah. Etymology. So it means you are so conquered and overwhelmed by the argument for the idea that you're just conquered by it. And we are going to speak with conviction. And we are going to conquer people with our ideas.
I'm sure all the jiu-jitsu players out there are wondering what these things, okay, these non-debatable points are.
I am certain.
Right.
Certain as I could be about anything. All I have complete conviction. And that's what people need to have, is conviction anyways, and commitment. Right. There's so many people are wishy-washy that come in to do jiu-jitsu. They're not sure with it. Just commit yourself and just do it. You know, there's power in that conviction. You don't have to make any more decisions. Once you commit to something, once you have conviction about what your goals are, what you're going to do in your process, everything gets easier. Okay, so here's the first one, Dan. View your BJJ training as a rare opportunity to learn. And our listeners can't see, but I put opportunity in all caps because I just love that word. If you think about it as a chore, like, oh, I got to go, I'm kind of tired, I don't know if I want to do this, or it's competition, am I going to win today, am I going to lose? It makes it too difficult, you know?
So I think this is getting lost over the... I think when I started, and certainly when you started, everyone thought that way because there was like only one jiu-jitsu school. You know what I mean? It was sort
Very
of like,
point.
This is a rare opportunity. It was obvious because it was like most of the country cannot learn jiu-jitsu. They cannot find a black belt to teach them.
Right.
Even now, some places don't have that. But certainly 20 years ago, it was like...
20 years ago, when I was training with Roberto Maia at Boston Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, my professor, I lived in Hyde Park, and the academy was in Watertown, and it took at least 35 minutes to get there. And I was thrilled to do it.
Right. Yeah. I think people way back when used to come down, like from New Hampshire, to go to your school.
I think they did. They came up from Rhode Island.
And when you're doing that, it's clear to you that, you know, like, this is an opportunity for me. Now, most people don't go more than, you know, I don't know how far, 15 minutes to the nearest school. And it's not as clear that it's a rare opportunity.
It's not as clear. You know,
it's sort of just a thing you can do or not do.
I think if you look at anything as opportunity, it just makes it so much better. I was doing those grueling hill workouts preparing for the competitions I did last year. And John Parson, one of our former students, he moved down to Connecticut. He still stops in occasionally. Great guy, great martial artist and jiu-jitsu player. And he was a great college runner. And he gave me this quote. That's basically the idea. He said, when you're doing these grueling hill workouts, don't think about it as it's grueling and I got to work hard. I have to do this. And this sort of embrace the grind meme that you hear. He said, look at it as an opportunity to get stronger, faster, fitter. It's an opportunity. And just approaching it like that, you approach a really tough workout with more enthusiasm. It ends up being a better workout.
I think it's great advice. I'm thinking, again, like most of our stuff, it applies outside of jiu-jitsu as
Definitely.
Well, right? Because I'm just thinking of my son. He wants, you know, he's starting to work out for the summer. And I just would assume he sees it as like, oh, I guess I got to go to the gym. Because I do it too, right?
Right.
Like, I'm not saying I'm above this. Where it's like for jiu-jitsu or the gym or anything where you're like, I guess I should run. And it's a interesting and valuable twist on it to think like, I have an opportunity. It's sort of like not everyone, I bought him a gym membership and it's like not everyone gets a gym membership. Like not everyone gets to, not everyone has the time. Not everyone has the opportunity to go 5 minutes and get to a gym.
That simple reframing of I get to do this instead of I have to do this makes a world of difference. Sometimes when we're in the kids' class, the class will be winding down, then maybe 5 minutes left, and they're losing their focus maybe a little bit, not always. So there might be a couple of guys doing these children doing jiu-jitsu, and they're losing a little focus. And I'll say to them, this works every time, Dad. I say, listen, there's 5 minutes left, and then I'm throwing you out of here. You're not allowed to do jiu-jitsu after 5 minutes. Yeah. 5 minutes, and it's off the table. And it works every time. They go, what?
I'm throwing you out of here
in 5 minutes. And they go, oh. And then they have renewed enthusiasm for their jiu-jitsu.
It's good. Like I said, I'm not immune to it too either. Like it's a good, I'll try to change my mindset for that as well.
You know, where I came up with this idea with the word opportunity was in my old business. So I had, as you know, I started a business that translated languages, translated documents from English into other languages and back into English in different cases and so forth. And as you can imagine, it's a subjective process when you're translating languages. So there's more than one way to go from one language into another. You can have different results. So, and there's a certain amount of quality control you need to have. And even with the highest quality control, there'll be mistakes. And the clients would often have a lot of insecurity about the whole process because most of the clients only spoke English. So if somebody said, yeah, there's something wrong in your French translation, they could get very anxious about that. And it might not be true. It might be a perfectly fine translation, but somebody commented, this doesn't look right, and they could freak out. So you got used to getting calls from panicked clients. And they were initially, I sort of dreaded those calls. So you got to talk somebody off the ledge, and we'll have to take a look at it and apologize if we made a mistake. And then I had a flip, and it was with this opportunity. So I started thinking anytime a client called me, it was an opportunity. Either they were going to send us more work, or if they had a problem with our work, it was an opportunity for us to fix it and improve our systems. So it was all just feedback, but it was better than feedback, Dan. It was always positive. So I had a process. Client said, you know, looks like we have a problem with this translation. I'm upset about it. I'd say, that's understandable. It's important for you to have great translation work here. Let's take a look at it. What are the supposed problems? Let's take a look at it and we'll get back to you. And if we did make mistakes, my process was I'd apologize for the mistake. I would compensate them. So I would discount the price or rebate them some price. And then we would change our systems to make the likelihood of that mistake to happen again in the future to drop.
Right.
And I had no defensiveness. So when they called, I wasn't defensive at all, even that emotional feeling. And what happened is people were so not used to getting that experience when they complained about something that our relationship got even closer.
Better, yeah.
We looked better. We had more credibility, more trust. We were more honest. We were more straightforward. And we were actually getting better. Our systems were improving because we would put in new fail safes and new quality checks that gave us a better product. So everything was an opportunity. So I took the word opportunity and I have it a sign in my office now. And I just at the time printed it out on an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper. And I taped it up on the wall that was in front of my desk where the phone was. So before I picked up the phone, I always saw the word opportunity. And I just approached every call with that attitude. And it just, everything was better. Yeah. Business was better. Our operations were better. Our product was better. Clients were happier. We had better relationships with them. So if we can just approach things with that idea, you said, this isn't just jujitsu, it works in life. Everything is an opportunity. And sometimes you hear that about jujitsu, where if I'm training and you sweep me or you get some outcome that I don't want, it's an opportunity to learn.
Right.
Yeah. But in this case with the business, it was even better than learning, even better than improving our systems. We built a closer relationship with our clients. So that's number one.
I'm also picturing myself in like one of my horrible jujitsu days being like, hey, here's another opportunity and another opportunity. And that's a third opportunity. Like a
lot of opportunities today.
Lot of ways to learn.
If you think about it, opportunity is sort of the metaphorical opposite of the pit of despair, I would suppose, right?
Yeah.
When your fingernails are clinging to the edge of the pit of despair, you're not seeing a lot of opportunity. So opportunity is key. And then to learn, I capitalize learn in this first commandment as well. And we talked about this before. If we come in to learn, we're always going to have a good day because we are going
to
learn.
As opposed to seeing if you're doing well or if you're better than someone or worse than someone. You're saying it's have in your head. And we talked about it a couple shows ago, I think, of like have in your head, I want to learn jujitsu while I'm here. I want to learn something.
Yeah. If that's our priority, we're going to end up also enjoying our training, probably going to
improve.
All your other goals were more likely to be accomplished if we start with learning. You know, socializing, having a good time, getting in shape, competing well, so forth and so on. It's all going to be better with that. So that's number one. What do you think?
All good.
Pretty solid.
Good start.
I don't even care what you think because I have conviction about these. Right. I have certainty about these.
Right. There's no debating them. And I haven't seen them, too, I should say, right? Like
you haven't? No. Let's see. I typed them up and I printed them in big letters so we could see without reading glasses or anything. So number two is train positionally. We talked about this as well, but this is huge. It just makes your training so much more productive because you get to see, for instance, if we're training from the mount and my training partner starts mounted on me and it's my job to protect myself from submissions and escapes, I just get so many more looks at the same position that I can tweak. And jiu-jitsu is about incorporating more and more finer distinctions into what you're doing. And if you're not visiting the same spot a lot, you just can't get deeper and you can't develop those distinctions.
Right. I think it's fairly common to get in a position you haven't been in a while. And I'll actually notice and be like, what do I do from here again? Like, you know, I'll sort of
right.
Like something a little that doesn't happen that much. Like someone that if you mount them, Billy Giovanella, if you mount, like he throws his legs up. And
if you're mounting him.
Yeah. He'll throw his legs up and
like a monkey,
sweep you over. Yeah.
Wrap them around your upper body.
And so then, I didn't know what to do. And
right.
Marcelo was like, oh, here's what I do. And then some time went by and he did it again. And I was consciously like, what did he say that I'm supposed to do from here? Like,
did you remember?
After I got swept.
So as you're flying through the air, you're like, right, I'm supposed to pummel my arms in. Yeah. Right.
Right. Exactly. Like now I remember what I should have done a couple seconds ago. That's a lot of my jiu-jitsu. But so all I'm saying is, for me, it's very obvious that if you don't revisit a position, I can forget what to do.
You're going to forget. Yeah. Exactly. The other thing about training positionally, Dan, is it feels less like competition. So if I start on the bottom of a mount and I get submitted, I'm less likely to go visit the pit of despair because it's just an exercise. It's an experiment. And I've already started way behind. So if I get submitted, my ego takes much smaller of a hit from it. And it's more scientific, right? You're a scientist. You need controls. If you don't have any controls, you can't really prove anything, right? And the other thing I like about it is, here's how I train positionally. You start on mount. If I escape or you submit me, we switch. And then I get on top. So you look at the position from, I would call it a 360-degree perspective. You see both sides of it. And I can see what you're trying to do to me when you're in the top or bottom position. And I can see how effective or ineffective that is and so forth. So you just get so much more information training that way.
Right. And your mindset also is one of learning. Like I'm going to start from bottom of mount, you're clearly working on that position as opposed to just...
Know what the opposite of training positionally is? This just popped in my head. And you see this in a lot of jiu-jitsu classes. Two guys on their knees facing each other and frantically grip fighting and pummeling their hands at each other.
Right. I've done it too.
I remember there was this one guy back when I was a white belt and he would just not let you grab him and you'd be on your knees flailing around for 5 minutes. We just wasted 5 minutes of possible training flailing around. So dopey and crazy. Okay, so that's number two. We're going through these pretty good, Dan.
Yeah, two is train positionally.
Train positionally. Oh, number three is challenge and support your teammates. So I put those in capital letters, the challenge and support, because you do need both. It's right. Sort of like what we were talking about last time when we were talking about the horrors of your fish tank and the ruthlessness of nature. That was the last podcast.
Our last off the rails podcast.
Dan, it was completely off the rails. It was fantastic. I was impressed that you had so many fish tank stories. I suspect that there's more. Yeah. But we were talking about how to compete in the right way. You know, how ruthless do we want to be? Do we want to eat our training partner's eyeballs or, you know, how do we want to do it? And I think this sort of answers it, that we want to challenge and support each other. We need both.
Right. Because you want, so I've jokingly in the gym before been like, let's teach the white belts all the wrong things so we can beat them. You know, like
it's like a Soviet disinformation campaign.
Right. Exactly. So that's like an extreme, and like, I'm just kidding, obviously, but like extreme opposite example of what you're there for. Like,
I think back in the day,
if you just want to win, that's what you do, right? Like, it's like, keep your elbows out. You want your arms away from your body.
Keep the arms as far away from the body. Project your neck.
Yeah, exactly. Keep your chin up. I think, as an exaggerated example though, right? Like, that's, if you just want to beat people, you don't support them. You don't help them. You don't want them to get better. You don't want to show them, like, if you're good at one position, you don't want them learning what to do. You don't, you know, and I think you and the other instructors have been pretty good about like showing people how to counter their own game, right? I don't know if you've talked about that before, but that's one way to help yourself get better, right? Like let people know how to beat you. You know what I mean?
Oh, right. And then, that's a good point, Dan.
You know, yeah. And then see if you can get better, and then they can't beat you, you know, like even though you've shown them. So, yeah, not everyone has that mindset, right? Like, you could feel more, if you're too competitive and you're not thinking about challenging and supporting teammates, you could just be like, I don't want them to know how to get out of this. I don't want them. I don't want to help them.
Which actually long term works against you, because if everyone else is getting better, it's just going to make you that much better as well. So you're going to, if you help your teammates get better, you will objectively get better yourself. But like you said, there are some individuals that don't care about that. They just want to be contextually the best. Like, in this context, in this moment, I want to get over on everybody.
Yeah. I mean, all the time people talk about in the gym how this feeling, especially for the newer people, that they always feel like they're not getting better because, first of all, there's that everyone around them is getting better.
Right.
And then secondly, because people try harder as you get better. You know, that's what I said. There's certain people.
Yeah.
Like white belts that I'm having the same role with, and they're so much better, but our role's the same, but now I'm trying my hardest. Like,
right.
You know, where it used to be, I'm just, you know, they're brand new.
You're playing with them before.
Playing, and now I'm like, I can't play. And like, so, but they might think there's no progress. Like, you know, the role feels exactly the same, but they're just not noticing that everyone's trying harder. You know, everyone's like, I can't mess around with this guy anymore. So I think that happens, and it's very common in the gym for people to think they're not getting better. Third thing that can happen, like with myself, is you actually aren't getting better. So that can also happen, but mostly it's the other thing.
I always try to help people. Of course, I'm the head instructor, but I think we have a really good environment and culture that way where we do help each other. I'm going to tell you something that annoys me and baffles me. I'll be training with somebody, I'll watch somebody, and they'll make something that is objectively a mistake, and maybe they get submitted or swept, and I'll go over to them and I'll say, here's what you want to do differently in that position, try this instead. And some maniacs will go and then they just go back to training like they don't even walk through it. I don't know what is going on in their empty skulls, but it drives me crazy. It's like, why would I? You know,
I think they just ignored what you said completely, or are they just...
It's their reflex, and I think it may have something to do with they don't want to admit that they made a mistake. Maybe it is something like their ego wants them to be perfect, so if I don't walk through it, then maybe it didn't really happen, which is a colossal mistake. Like, if I make a mistake and somebody shows me what I should be doing differently, I want to walk through it a few times to start to get it into my nervous system. You know, that's right. How your nervous system works. If you tell me to do something, it's different than if I drill it and try to make it happen. I don't mean go drill it for an hour. I mean, but for God's sakes, you got to do it at least two or three times. But some people don't. It's crazy. I think it's because they don't want to make a mistake. They don't want to look bad. And the reality is, you should be trying to make mistakes in front of your instructor, because then they can get fixed.
Right.
So I go over and I train with crew Mark Delagrati at Sit Your Tongue in Somerville on a regular basis. And
so this is stand-up. This is
For Muay Thai kickboxing. So there'll be times, you know, we're an official affiliate of Sit Your Tongue, and I've been training. I first got introduced to Muay Thai kickboxing from Steve Whittier, who's also affiliated with them. And
probably most people listening know who Mark Delagrati is, but if anyone doesn't, I've heard nothing but good things about Mark Delagrati, like across the nation, of how good he is as an instructor for Muay Thai.
He's an amazing instructor and teacher, one of the best teachers I've ever experienced, and one of the best coaches from everything, from youth sports all the way up, one of definitely maybe the best coach I've ever had the privilege of working with. But sometimes he'll have you just go, all right, shadow box. I'm going to watch your shadow box. And you can, as a student, you can feel a little self-conscious, like right. I'm pretending to be fighting and somebody's observing me and I want to have good technique. And what I realize is the best thing to do, and it's easier said than done, is don't be self-conscious. Just do what you do and let your mistakes shine, because then he can say, you know what, maybe think about doing this instead of doing that. Where if you're trying to be perfect, oddly enough, your performance degrades dramatically, and then your real mistakes aren't even being exposed. Right. So the best is just to like put it out there.
And I think everyone knows, like, when an instructor watches is when you're most likely to start screwing it up. Like this,
a little bit more self-conscious. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, people, if you're walking and you know there's a group of people watching you walk away, you can be like,
am I walking all weird?
Am I walking normally? Like, let alone like something complicated. Like,
that is so funny. Like, for the film that we're doing with Mark McNally and Zoran and Sasha and all those guys, they do something where they go, we need some B-roll. We need you walking down this road. Right. And it's exactly like
that.
So
they're like, how do I walk? Yeah.
Plus, it takes a certain amount of time for the cinematographer to set up the shot and get all the lighting right and everything, because they want it to look just really terrific. And then they're like, okay, now you walk by here. And it's exactly that, Dan. All of a sudden, you can't walk. You feel like a weirdo and a robot. Yeah. Now, do it again. And then go this way. It's really strange. Very hard to do. I asked Zoran about that. We got to get him in here. It's a time for an interview. Have you noticed this sometimes in movies or TV shows? The characters are eating a lot during a conversation.
Yeah.
It drives me crazy. They're blah, blah, blah. And I asked him, like, why do they always have these people eating? Like, eating isn't that big of life, is it? That all these conversations are being had with somebody chewing on something. And I guess it's just some device to make things seem more natural. Like, apparently, he said, if an actor is not told what to do with their hands, they don't know what to do with them. Yeah. It gets really awkward unless, you know, they're particularly good actors.
Like, so you're saying that eating just makes the audience feel like it's...
Well, it gives the actors something that they have to do with their hands. So they don't have to think about now what are they going to do with their hands.
Right.
Yeah. So I don't know how I got on that tangent, but...
Challenge and support your teammates.
Don't be afraid of making mistakes. That'll be on next week. Okay. Directive number 4. Try to stay injury free. That seems kind of obvious, right? But, you know, jiu-jitsu is about self-defense and it's about protecting yourself. So sometimes I see people, beginners for the most part, who train in such a spastic way that they just end up hurting themselves and they're missing the whole point of it. The whole point is to protect yourself. So you're doing something that injures yourself. That's the opposite of self-defense. That's self-offense. You know, it's just crazy.
And it can be counterproductive for technique as well, because we've all done it, so it's not even a criticism, but new people, like if you're trapped underneath, they'll just, you know, buck wildly to try to get out. First of all, you don't get out, and then second of all, you're not learning how to get out. Like even if you do, say you're like a real strong guy or something, you just flail until you're out. It can work, but you're not learning how to get out, right? Like you're
not learning, because it has to be systematic. It has to be scientific. You have to develop something that's repeatable.
Right.
If you're just completely improvising all the time to the point where you don't even remember what you did, it's not very repeatable, right?
Right. And I would say for, especially with new people, one of the most effective things they can do is to go wild, right? Like it's actually, you know, like if you picture day two, you don't have much technique. Maybe the best thing you can do, especially you're athletic or strong, is to go crazy, right? Like that might be your best way to get out, or the best way to pass guard is just being wild. But that's also how you get injured and how you don't learn technique, right? So
you don't learn technique. No, you can't repeat what you're doing. That's why when you do, it all goes hand in hand. If you do the positional training, you're less likely to go wild. You're less likely to start to actually figure out a system to accomplish your goals or to escape or to submit your training partner.
And then the same thing where you it applies again to people not thinking they're getting better because they calm down. And like when you first calm down, we've seen this. I think we've even talked about it. It's pretty common, like 2 weeks in or 2 months in or whatever it is. They calm down and you're temporarily less effective. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, like that's interesting, Dan. Very true.
I think you can be temporarily, like now you're not passing anymore because you're not going crazy.
Right.
You're actually on the road to getting better, but I think I've seen people get
a lot of things
discouraged by that.
In life is like that, where when you're doing something correctly, you feel like you're taking a step backwards in output.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that would be true of anything, right? Like if you're used to if you're a kid and you're used to making free throws with a basketball, like underhanded, and then you switch to a correct form, you're going to be worse at first.
Yeah.
Right? You're going to miss more.
Very true.
It's all to get better in the long run.
Okay. Number five is the same as four, basically. Try not to injure your teammates. And it's probably very similar, the same thing.
It goes hand in hand.
Yeah. Right? And if you're one of those people that tends to accidentally injure a lot of people, you should probably take a look at how you're operating, you know, because you're not just unlucky. You're systematically doing something that's causing people injury. So stop it. Okay. We're on to number six. This is similar to number five, too. Never sag on takedowns, mat returns. Learn mat returns.
What are mat returns?
That's a great question, Dan. So mat returns could be I'm in a turtle position and I have my hands around my opponent's waist and the guy stands up. So now I'm sort of standing behind him with my arms around his waist. This is actually a very common position. It's common in wrestling. It's common in MMA. And it's common in jiu-jitsu. You need to have a mat return. A mat return is taking them back down to the mat.
Actually returning to the mat, right?
Exactly. Okay. Returning them to the mat. And I think this is something, if you're into jiu-jitsu, especially no-gi, but even gi, you should have a mat return mastered and use it every time. So what happens when people don't have a mat return? They just improvise, and they're like, I got to get this guy back down any way possible. And sometimes what happens is they almost use their own body weight as ballast, and they sort of like just let their feet go and sag down, hoping that this extra weight that's offset of the person standing somehow off balances them, and they all go falling to the mat.
Right. Or even worse, right? You've said they'll use – it's like sag on them and use weight, and also like sort of off to the side, like to try to
– right. So then what happens is their weight – you know, basically their hips come and crash into the side of the guy's knee that they're holding on to. And that can cause a catastrophic injury. You could tear your ACL. So that happened to Dominic Cruz. He's sparring MMA with guys that know how to fight and everything. And the guy sagged on him like this and tore his ACL. And then he was out for a significant amount of time from training. So you can't do that to your training partners. You have to learn a mat return that's going to get your training partner safely back to the mat.
Right. And the reason it got its own number is that it's common, right?
Yeah, it's common, and it can result in catastrophic injury if you don't do
it
right.
Like you gave the example of Dominic Cruz, but it's happened in the gym as well. And
almost happened to me, and I was able to turn my knee at the last moment. This is many years ago. I felt my knee completely separating. The femur was coming apart from the fibula and the tibia, and oh my gosh, and at the last moment I turned and avoided serious injury.
Especially now, I think maybe this is sort of a tangential point, but there's a lot of, I'm noticing like a lot of people attacking knees and ankles. You know what I mean? Like a lot of leg locks now.
Oh, okay.
It sort of seems, I don't know if I'm right about this, but it feels like that's the direction jiu-jitsu is going. Like it's a...
You know what I think it is, Dan? I think it was a neglected area for some period of time.
Right, because they used to say Sambo had it. Right, and yep. Not jiu-jitsu.
Well, in the IBJJF, you still cannot do heel hooks, and they limit the attacks you can do at various belt levels.
Right, and the reason they limit it is there's so much catastrophic injury associated with it, right?
I mean, think there's a perception that they're more dangerous. I'm not exactly sure if they are. They might be, but yeah.
I mean, for me, I feel like I just tap almost immediately whenever I sort of picture it as a loss if they get me in a heel hook position, or you know what I mean?
I think
like,
that's a great way to look at it.
I'll just be like, if you, I lose if you get me there. Like, you don't have to finish it. Like, that's.
I agree.
I remember way back when there used to be less tapping, I think, you know, it was more savage times, and I got my ankle popped. I was a white belt and just popped my ankle, just wrenched it. And now I don't want to be in that position ever again. That hurts, you know, and it's a lasting,
you don't want that. Yeah.
Lasting injury. You know, I think my ankle's better, but, you know, it takes a year. You know, it can be a bad, you know what I mean? Some of these leg locks are, you know, heel hooks. And then they say that you can't, because I've never had my knee blown out with a heel hook or, you know, one of these things, but they say that you can't always feel it. You know what I mean?
Like I think the idea is that the ligament gives out without any pain warning in front of it. There's probably some truth to that, yeah.
Yeah.
So you just have to train the position and understand the position and know when you're in danger.
Right. Okay. Just careful with knees in general.
That definitely.
Applies to don't sag on the takedowns.
Don't sag on the takedowns. Learn your mat return. Okay, number seven, we don't have to spend too much time on, but it's wash your gear every time. I mean, it's gross if you don't, and it also spreads, you know, ringworm, germs, and fungus and things like this. And
every time.
Every time. I remember there was one guy, I would say, wash your gear every time. Wash your gi, your uniform, every time. And he would say, yeah, unless you just did a little light rolling, then make sure you air it out. No, wash it every time.
It's not
so weird that he would resist that. Yeah.
No nuance to this one.
Dan, back in Dedham, we had a kid that trained with us, and I think he went to school. So he didn't train for the whole school year. So he must have stopped training in September, came back in June or something, came onto the mat, started training. And oh my God, this guy's uniform smelled so bad. It smelled like one of your fish that had died a horrible death and was left out for a week in the sun or something. And it occurred to me that this guy had his last day of training, August 31st or something, and he balled up his gi in a bag and then came back June 1st and took it out and put it on. And I was like, you can't do that, dude. I mean, it was so awful and offensive. And you know what? The guy never came back again. I somehow offended him by telling him this. Yeah. Wacky, right?
Although I have heard people ask if they have to wash their belt before. I think you don't really have to.
I think you should. Here's the thing. I think you should probably wash your belt because it's a piece of cloth. It's exposed to the same bacteria and so forth. You should wash it, you know. Yeah, but there are
why
some.
Why not, right?
Yeah, there are some magic thinking people that say don't wash your belt. But yeah, you should probably wash it. Okay, number eight. This one seems obvious, but it isn't. Become effective with your techniques. And effective is the capitalized word. So this becomes more obvious when people go to compete, where they've sort of, quote unquote, learned and drilled 12 different takedowns, but they've never really become effective in any of them. So if you're not effective with your techniques, they almost work against you. It's like you were saying, when you're the white belt thrashing about, you have a certain level of effectiveness. Now when you dial it back and try techniques, you're less effective because you haven't made your techniques effective yet. So it's like having a gun with no bullet in it. You know what I mean? I go to a gunfight with a gun with no bullet. It's probably worse than if I had nothing, because then I was run and cower or whatever. So that's a mistake. But people don't limit their techniques in the beginning to get effective. If it's not effective, it's worse than useless. It's going to work against you. If I have an ineffective takedown, so I should define effective. I would say effective means some substantial part of the time, 40% of the time, I can actually make it work against a resisting opponent of my level. How does that sound?
Sounds good. Because it sounds obvious, and I've heard it, but I was notoriously bad about this, where I probably got into jiu-jitsu and learned, say, passing someone's guard, I was probably shown 20 ways to do it.
Right.
And I go into roles and say I was in someone's guard, and I still have a little bit of this where I just don't know what I want to do. You know, I'm like, I know 20 different, I'm like, I'll just pull one out.
You have the paralysis of choice.
None
right?
of them are effective.
Yeah.
Right? Like, to your point, like, it'll sort of be like, or you know a lot of ways to pass, and I'll just start trying them. And what I've been doing after years, I should have figured this out in like weeks instead of years, but like, is to just be like, here's my pass. Let me try this pass. And, or maybe two passes, as you said before. And like, get effective with those. And because people would ask me, you know, they'd be like, what is your game? And I'd be like, I don't have a game. Like, I just go, you know, and it wasn't
usually
effective.
What we want to do is have complementary techniques. Mm-hmm. And when I say complementary, I mean techniques that make a whole, right. Make a one thing.
So if they try to defend one thing, you go to this other one.
Yeah.
It's a good thing to go to if they respond in a certain way to your first one.
Exactly. And instead of doing 20 techniques that are unrelated and not complementary.
Because you hear that from like world level competitors all the time, right? Like world class competitors that they're like, I don't have a million.
If you watch people, yeah, you watch the highest level world championship matches, yeah, they're working within a system. They're working within a limited number of moves for the most part. You know, they probably could do a lot of different things, but you need a game plan. You just can't come in and do everything. You know what this reminds me too, of this idea of being effective? I was listening to a Rogan podcast today, and they were talking about some ESP type of stuff and these types of things, remote viewing and the Army was involved, and they're trying to, you know, make goats die by looking at them, stare at goats and everything. And all of that kind of, what do you call that, ESP type stuff?
Yeah.
It goes back to, if you can bend a spoon by looking at it, great, but that's not effective. You know what I mean? Can you literally, if you can kill somebody by looking at them or thinking about them, then that's effective. But if you're just bending a spoon, I don't care how amazing it is. It's not, it doesn't rise to the level of effective, right?
That's like back at our super popular ghost episodes.
Right.
Where we said, like, if a ghost, what it's able to do is one time over 20 years, like move something like 2 inches.
What's the point?
Who even cares?
Who even cares? Right. If I can guess the flip of a coin 50.01% of the time, is it even effective? Does it even matter? You know? Is that, if that's the level of your psychic ability, it doesn't rise to the level of being effective for anything, then it's useless.
Right. Yeah. So with jujitsu, I also had this where, like, this one pass I'd always try. This is a while ago, but I remember rolling with someone and they were like, oh, is that like your go-to pass? And I'm like, yeah, that's, I guess that you'd call it my go-to pass. And he was like, oh, you have success with it? I was like, no.
But we're going to keep going to it until it's successful.
It is my go-to. It doesn't work. But so the point here, point eight, is become effective. Like, if you have a go-to pass.
Become effective, yeah.
Get it into working shape.
And avoid the siren call of exotic techniques when you're a blue belt or whatever, right. You know.
And I'm still working. Like, I'm revisiting. I'm like, my escapes are garbage. They're not effective. So I'm still, after years, I'm revisiting. I'm like, you know, of course I've been shown how to escape a million times, but I never really got it down. So I'm like, let me try to get this.
So how do you think you would get it down, Dan?
I have no idea. No, I'm just, just kidding. Train positionally.
Yes.
Right.
Exactly.
So and that's what I've been doing. Train positionally to get effective.
Yeah.
I'm on it.
On it. Awesome. Okay, we're on number 9. We actually might make it through all 10 of the directives today.
That's the goal, right?
That'd be a record for us. That's never happened before. Okay, number 9. This flow roll with teammates you're much better than. So I probably have to give this.
Did we talk on the podcast or just outside of the podcast about this? Because what I was saying, what I always heard traditionally was, you want to, you know, the greatest thing is to roll with a black belt, or like, imagine how much you could learn if you rolled with Marcelo Garcia or Hicks and Gracie, like, it would be awesome. But that's not always true, right? Like,
I think you can learn some things, but yeah,
it's
one way to learn things. I mean, Danaher recently, John Danaher, the coach down at Henzo Gracie's in New York, he said it was a very large number. I think he said you should spend 85 or 90%. He had like some really large percentage of your time you should be training with people that you are much better than, which
we don't have the luxury of doing all the time.
Most of us don't. Yeah. But what it allows you to do is to tinker, to experiment, and to figure out your offense and make changes, introduce. It's like a stand-up comic. They got to introduce new material. You just can't come out, you know, with a Showtime special, a Netflix special. You got to develop it. So that allows you to develop it.
See what works, what doesn't.
The other thing about flow roll, though, Dan, this term has been around for maybe 20 years that I know of, and it used to be this mythical thing that you and I, guys who are like at the same level, we're just going to flow roll and you're going to sweep me and then I'm going to escape and we're going to move slowly. And I never could do that. I didn't even know what it means. I'm like, I'm supposed to let somebody sweep me? Why would I do that? Isn't that counter to what I want to learn? Isn't I teaching myself the wrong thing? And what I found, my experience with flow rolling had been, is people say, hey, let's just do a little flow rolling. And you go, sure. And they start passing your guard and you defend a little bit and they pass a little bit harder. You defend a little bit harder. They pass harder. You defend harder. Next thing you know, you're going at a frenzied pace.
But I feel like you do flow roll, like, if you define flow roll as not trying your hardest, right? Like, you know, like, if I roll with you, you just don't go your hardest. Isn't that a flow roll?
I think it is, but it only works because I'm dictating the pace because I have more experience than you. And I can pull it off. Where if I'm going with somebody who I don't have more experience then. I can't really do that because I can't dictate the pace right. then. So then it's not really going to be a flow roll.
But this makes sense. So the point was to flow roll with teammates you're much better than.
Right.
That's partly because
that is flow rolling. Because
right, you can dictate the pace.
Otherwise, I don't think it's flow rolling.
But it's a good example because say like triangle. Like I never triangle anymore.
Right.
And if I want to practice my triangles, most of the people in the gym, I am never, ever going to get them.
Correct.
So if I want to get better at that, I have to do it with new people, you know, with new or white.
You have to. It's funny you should bring up that example because I have relatively shorter legs. I never dreamed of triangle choking somebody. And I spent one, I think it was a summer, maybe it was a year. And I went to this one class at Boston Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And I think I was a purple belt. And the other guy was a white belt. Very nice guy. He was a little smaller than me. I think I would say physically not as strong as me. And I was a purple belt and he was a white belt. And I learned to triangle people with him. And I would not have learned it unless I was training with him. And he was a good guy and he was good and he was enthusiastic, but I just had so much more experience and just worked out for me. And I wasn't a dick about it. I didn't torture the guy and I try to help him out, help him learn. But it was key in me developing my guard and especially developing my triangle choke. It wouldn't have happened otherwise.
Right. And so you bring up a point too that, you know, without torturing these newer people, the newer people also have to accept that they have that role too. Like people are going to get things on them and going to work on their technique with them and not always baby them.
You shouldn't always baby them. No, that's a good point. Sometimes people fall in that trap. I tell a student, go train with that guy over there, that white belt. And instead of them trying to implement their offense, they give the guy a lecture for the whole time. And I'm like, yeah, that's not the point of it. You know, you could help them out, like point out one or two things, but you got to get your training in here and let them get their training in too. But it comes from a good place. They're trying to be helpful.
Right.
Okay, we're on the last one. We're at number 10. The 10th, what do we want to call these? Directives? Must-dos?
You're away from commandments.
Commandments?
A little biblical.
A little biblical. Yeah, we'll call them commandments. This is the 10th. We're going to have more than 10. We're going to add more. This is the 10th jiu-jitsu commandment. Put the jiu-jitsu ahead of yourself. Do you know what I mean by that?
I might.
So I think we talked about this before.
I would assume you mean ego. Like,
I think while you're rolling, I can't be in Marcelo Garcia's head, but it seems to me, and when I watch him compete and I watch him train, that he just loves the jiu-jitsu so much, he doesn't even care who's winning. And it's not that he's not putting in a complete effort. It's just that the jiu-jitsu is more important than any particular outcome. He's not attached to any outcome, although he is. Right. It's kind of a Zen thing. You know, he's got two things going at the exact same time. It's like he's trying to do his best jiu-jitsu, but whatever jiu-jitsu results is more important than even
it's
him winning.
Related to using the opportunity to learn.
Right.
And I think this is what you mean, right? Like if you're rolling, think of it as your jiu-jitsu and someone else is doing jiu-jitsu as opposed to like, I should be beating this guy or...
I think I should, so. You could even say jiu-jitsu is happening. So if something happens and the guy swings into an arm bar and I have to tap, I don't say to myself, God damn it, why did that happen to me? You say, that was an amazing technique, the way he came underneath. And you learn from the experience and you appreciate what happened. You know, you don't beat yourself up.
Right.
For
and sort of take ego out of it and don't even think about like this. I can't believe that guy beat me, or I can't believe I had trouble with this person or that person. Right. It's just like, it's just the jiu-jitsu, right?
Yeah. I know it's not easy to do,
right?
But yeah, ego gets a bad name. Having a healthy ego is good because then you have higher expectations of yourself. Maybe you try harder, have a good effort. But I think the fragile ego where you're afraid to have your ego take a hit, that's what works against you. You know the guy, that runner, Prefontaine, famous runner? Have you ever seen any of those movies about him?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, some cool movies. Yeah. He's up in Oregon. Famous runner. And there's a scene in one of the movies where he says something like, I'm going to break a world record this year. And he says it to two of the coaches. And the assistant coach says something like this to the head coach, wow, what an ego on that guy. And the head coach says, yeah, I wish more of our athletes had that kind of ego.
Right.
He's actually going to do something special now. So I think that's...
It's good to have a big ego, just not fragile ego.
I think that's probably the way to phrase it, yeah. And be able to put it in its place when you're training. So that's it, Dan. We made it through all 10.
Why don't you read them off?
Read them off. because I am certain about these. These are must-dos.
Right. These are not optional. These are not.
Number one, view your BJJ training as a rare opportunity to learn. Opportunity, learn. Number two, train positionally. Positionally. Number three, challenge and support your teammate. Four, try to stay injury free. Five, try not to injure your teammate. Six, never sag on takedowns, mat returns. And for God's sakes, learn a mat. Get effective at a mat return. Seven, wash your gear every time, every single time. Eight, become effective with your techniques. Until your techniques become effective, they're actually working against you. Flow roll with teammates you are much better than. And number 10, put the jiu-jitsu ahead of yourself. What do you think?
All good.
Pretty goddamn good. Awesome, Dan. So I think we're down to it.
Yeah.
That's the end of the podcast. And I don't have to like tie in all these nutty ideas this time.
Right. We're straight. You just read them off, right?
Just read them off. But don't worry if you like the crazy fish tank stories. We'll have more of that in the future.
We were off the rails last time. This one was more on the rails.
I think these two episodes balance each other out nicely. Awesome. So thanks, everybody, for listening. Thank you, Dan, again, for a brilliant podcast. Please like, subscribe, share this, review it, tell all your friends about it, tell them to listen, and we will talk to you next week.